from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Famed author, editor, and scriptwriter Dave Eggers will be joining us in the hour ahead to discuss his newest book, which is all about the devastation of Katrina and how it affected one family in particular, a Muslim couple who were living ordinary lives as hardworking people and community-dedicated citizens until the devastation of Katrina changed everything and turned what they had come to believe about the United States and its values and concern for its citizens completely around. Dave Eggers joins us in the hour ahead, which will include your calls and emails, coming up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Bay Area author and founder and editor of McSweeney's, Dave Eggers, is also co-founder of 826 Valencia and the author of What is the What, as well as a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, You Shall Know Our Velocity and How We Are Hungry. And he's co-founder and co-editor of Voice of Witness, a series of books using oral history to illuminate human rights crises around the world. His most recent book is Zaytoun, the story of a humble Syrian-born house painter named Abdulraham Zaytoun and his family, who go through an ordeal and trauma of epic proportions as Katrina hits their beloved home city of New Orleans and puts it underwater. Zaytoun elects to stay in New Orleans after his wife and children flee the storm-ravaged city, and he helps people and animals in distress until he's arrested and put in a makeshift facsimile of Guantanamo Bay and denied all rights, even including a proverbial single phone call. Dave Eggers joins us for this forum hour. Good morning. Welcome to. Good to have you.
Morning.
I was very taken with this story. It's an incredible odyssey. You take us from his humble beginnings to his success as a house painter and landlord, and all that, and inside the life of his family. Where did you get hold of this story?
Well, there was a Kathy Zaytoun, Abdurrahman's wife, wrote a brief account of it for legal proceedings to, you know, sort of file a civil suit. And her lawyer asked her to do so. And the lawyer had it got to a friend who had a friend at the Times-Picayune, the NOLA.com website. And it went up there, just a page and a half maybe, the brief account. And then when we were working on Voices from the Storm, our oral history book about New Orleanians before and after Katrina, we tracked him down, the family, Kathy and Abdurrahman, and asked them to tell the story at greater length. And so maybe 6 or 7 pages of the story appeared in that book, which wove together 13 lives who were affected by the storm. And after it appeared there, I got to know the Zaytouns, and we started discussing telling the whole story all the way back from his birth in Syria and going until the present.
Very dependent, this book, on their memories of things, really. Huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but, you know, luckily they had documented it for legal reasons and talked about it among each other. And we got started on the book in 2006, just about a year after the storm. So memories were quite fresh.
This is, I think, a book that makes us really care about these people. I think you execute that quite well and bring about, because you're in their heads often, but make us care about them as people, as a family, and really want them to do okay in spite of all of that they face.
Well, they're so incredibly likable and just so normal. I mean, one of the goals was to sort of de-exoticize the idea of a Muslim American family, like thinking that their daily lives or their goals or what, you know, their children are somehow vastly different from any people of any other faith. I mean, it's a ridiculous idea, but I think that we go around with a lot of us with this in their head, like, well, I'm sure their daily lives and their home lives are so much different. But, you know, having spent a lot of time with them, everything is, they're the most all-American family you'll ever find. And also just the most, they're a lot of fun to be around. And like, I just love hanging out at their house. And so
they're better than most people. I mean, they're good, decent people who really care.
Yeah, they are. You know, I mean, it's a basic tenet of the Muslim faith, you know, to sort of to look after those less fortunate and to try to, you know, make a more just and society, and they take that seriously. And so every day they, you know, from employing a lot of people in New Orleans, which they do as a painter contractor, to taking care of all their tenants. And, you know, I've met a lot of their tenants there. Everybody says they're the best landlord they've ever had. You know, it's, they're very casual about everything, and they sort of juggle it all with an incredible ease and generosity that, yeah, is really sort of a model for anybody. But they're, you know, they know every single neighbor in the neighborhood. They're the first ones to come if anybody's in trouble, and it's just part of their basic being, you know, and they carry it pretty lightly.
We should mention that she's he's Syrian-born, and she converted to Islam, American-born, in fact, in Louisiana. There is this kind of there's this moment, this shift in the narrative when he decides to stay, of course. And I don't want to spoil the story because it's really novelistic in the way you do it. But he decides to stay. His family's left. And on the one hand, he stays because of his faith, as you suggested, because of his decency and goodness of character. But he's also a stubborn guy. I mean, you bring that out.
He had never left in advance of any storm. And he's a workaholic. Like, he won't, you know, they own a lot of rental properties around the city, and they had, at any given time, 10 jobs that they're working on all over town. And he's got keys to, you know, probably 100 other houses because of his clients who say, listen, if anything ever happens, here's my keys to my house. You look after it. Everybody trusts Zaytoun with their property. And so he felt this sense of responsibility and to not abandon his house itself. And, you know, and he grew up on the coast of Syria, and his you know, father and grandparents were born and raised on an island called Arwad Island off the coast, which is like perpetually hit by storms and nobody ever flees and it floods. And so he has this sort of heroic ancestry where it's...
Well, his brother was a world champion swimmer.
Yeah, right? His brother Mohammed was the most famous Syrian athlete maybe of the 20th century, a long-distance champion swimmer. And so he's got a lot to live up to. He's got this sort of pride in his family, and he's not somebody that's going to be easily... he's not going to flee easily. So he stayed, and, you know, Kathy and the kids went up to Baton Rouge. And you know, after a day, he, like a lot of people, said, well, that was the storm, no big deal. He told Kathy and the kids to come back. But that was before the water came up again.
But there was a lot of the sense of God's will and serving God and Allah with respect to helping people. He had this canoe, and in fact, the canoe became sort of his own lifeline to providing the kind of service that went with the honor of his family and the faith that he believed in.
Well, that's what, you know, one of the things that first attracted me to the story was finding out about Arwad Island, which we don't all think of Syria having an island off of the coast of the country. And so he was surrounded by water as a youth, and he never...
In fact, the book starts with him fishing, actually.
Yeah, fishing and, you know, this... type of fishing to attract sardines at night, where you put a lamp close to the water called lampara, an old sort of Mediterranean trick. And but he, you know, he bought this secondhand canoe from one of his clients, and Kathy made fun of him. What are you going to do with a canoe around here? And what do we, you know? But he has all these sort of eccentric, you know, tastes, and they're always taking in pets or buying oddball things. And then after the water came up, he started setting out every day and making what he called his rounds, where he would check on all of his properties, paddle around, check on the houses, check on his family's, his friends' properties, the houses he's worked on. And pretty soon he realized, even on that first full day of rounds, he realized that there was something specific to the power of that canoe, where he was so quiet, whereas he saw these fan boats and motorboats cruising around the city, they're so loud. He, in this quiet canoe, could hear faint cries for help. And so within about a few hours of setting out, he heard an old woman's cry from a house nearby, and he and a neighbor were able to save her life, you know, and she was floating near the ceiling of her house, an elderly woman, probably in her 80s.
This is a woman who's overweight, too.
Yeah, she's over, you know, I think she was 250 or so pounds and very hard to sort of get into the canoe. And But were it not for the canoe, and were it not for him going around and listening, she would have probably died because she had already floated, you know, been there overnight for 24 hours. So, you know, and so he continued to do that day after day, going around and feeling like he was there for a reason, and that God had put him there to help.
And feeding dogs and taking care of dogs as well.
Well, they've done that for years. I was just there a couple of days ago, and now they have ducks. So they're always taking in some pet or some lost animal. And he considers it, you know, a real, you know, basic part of his faith and the way his family operates is like if there's an animal in trouble, they're going to take it in. And so he found out, even on that first day, that there were dogs all over the neighborhood that he would hear crying all night. So he went in search of them. And he would have to climb a tree, put a plank from the tree to a roof, crawl in, break through the window, and then he would find dogs that had been left all over because the residents had thought they would be back in a day or two. But in some cases, it was right across the street. There were two dogs in a cage because the owner didn't apparently want them fighting over food or something. So she had put them in a cage, and so he freed them. And then every day part of his rounds would be to take some frozen meat from his freezer, bring it to the dogs, you know, walk from plank to plank, you know, high over the water, feed these dogs, get back into his canoe, and then look for people he might help.
Talking with local author Dave Eggers, whose book Zaytun came out last week, and all the proceeds of this book, we ought to add, are going to the Zaytun Foundation and to help those who have suffered as a result of Katrina. It's kind of a curious question in a general way. We've talked before about, on a couple of occasions publicly as well as on the air, about your last book, What is the What?, which profiles young men who also showed enormous courage and determination under great pressure. Valentino in Africa, part of the Lost Boys. What draws you to these very human individual stories? I mean, is it just something that clicks in you that says, I've got to tell this story like a magnet, or how is it?
I think, my training in college was in journalism, and so I have from the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and it's a great journalism school taught by real old school guys, or I was, you know, taught by these guys, and they really, sort of beat in, I guess, a sense of responsibility to sort of use whatever skills you might have or acquired and try to get a story that needs to be told out there. And it took me a long time to sort of, you know, I came to all of this pretty late. I think I was almost 30 before I first wrote a book or was successful in getting one finished. And so I'm kind of continuously amazed that any book I write comes to anything or like gets finished in the first place, because I don't feel, you know, I feel like I'm still learning the trade. And but
is this what they used to call new journalism in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, it was, you know, those guys were very influential to me. Like, I love, you know, Joan Didion and Tom Wolfe and Michael Herr and Norman Mailer's Executioner song was the closest, you know, corollary to this book, to Zaytun, because there you have a guy with a really overpowering style when he wants to. And he stripped it completely bare for this book and just got out of the way of the story. And it's, you know, it's one of my favorite books.
And there's Mailer dealing with Gary Gilmore trying to get it evil. Here you're dealing with Zaytun trying to get it good.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a big difference.
Exactly. But you know, so much of it is just listening for, you know, over the course of years and sort of, and just putting it down without any sort of extra flourishes, I guess you'd say. And, you know, in this case, you really have to, you're limited by what you can prove, too. So the language and everything becomes a little bit more, I guess, I don't know what you'd say, but plainer in a way. You know, you don't get to sort of...
You have your poetic moments here.
Yeah, here and there. But, you know, I'm attracted to epics, I guess, when I read or, you know, when I... And I think if you're going to spend 4 years like I did on What is the What? Or 3 years on this, like, they're better. And it's good if there's a wide scope and if there's something, you know, I think meaty to talk about.
This is an epic. I thought about Gilgamesh, in fact, and, you know, great flood stories that predated Noah. But I also thought about, because it's novelistic, I thought about Frank Norris's novel. I don't know if you ever read Norris the Octopus, because there are shifting back and forth stories. I mean, you take us right up to a certain point where, well, he's guns are coming at him, for example, and then we're with Kathy.
Well, you know,
it's a novelistic technique.
Yeah, I mean, that was like the one sort of structural I don't know, innovation or whatever I allowed, because I, but that was to say, you know, I, the first book in the Voice of Witness series was called Surviving Justice that I co-edited, and we talked about at this table. And that, you know, one of the effects, this is about wrongfully incarcerated men and women in the U.S. And one of the things I learned there was this, like, this incredibly long sort of set of ripple effects that happens when somebody's put in jail, and especially wrongfully. It's not one guy or one woman in jail and they get out and everything's good. It's like the way that it affects the family, extended family, is profound and really long lasting. And so when Zaytoun is, he disappears one day. He was talking to his wife, Kathy, every day from a phone in one of their houses. And then suddenly she doesn't hear from him one day. And she's seeing all the, you know, the images on CNN of all this, you know, supposed chaos all over the city. And she expects the worst, that her husband has succumbed to, you know, some kind of violence. And so we stay with Kathy for some time there because, you know, she didn't hear from him for almost 3 weeks. So, you know, the effect of that, if a mother of five who, you know, when her husband disappears and she has no contact with him, she only could assume the worst and almost had to plan a life without him. And all, you know, for sort of preventable reasons. And so I wanted to sort of show that effect and that had on her family. And, you know, he has a very close family in Syria and in Malaga, Spain, as his closest brother, Ahmed, lives there. And everybody was losing their minds, you know. And so it's important, I think, to show sort of how it affects everybody else, too.
It was also important for you to show how, in the wake of all this hysteria over supposed rapes going on and murders going on, I mean, there was certainly violence, but it created an atmosphere that allowed, while there were so many things that needed to be tended to, them to create this makeshift gitmo, as I described it in the introduction, in New Orleans, and put him in a cage, essentially, and take away his rights, not even give him a phone call.
Well, there was an overwhelmingly military response to what was a humanitarian problem. And I think partly because of, you know, and there were a lot of people in positions of power in New Orleans, like you know, Eddie Compass and Eddie Jordan and Mayor Nagin, even they were all, you know, spreading these rumors of incredible violence in the Superdome and the convention center. Most of these were totally unfounded rumors. And so the law enforcement and the, you know, National Guard and all these police units from all over the country that came to New Orleans to help came thinking that they were entering a war zone with their guns raised. And so they kept encountering residents who were just desperately trying to live and be rescued. And they, you know, usually so many of them came with their guns pointed at them, thinking that they were, I don't know, that they were, you know, conquering some chaotic other nation, I guess, in a way. And so it was unfortunate because you had a lot of good people. I interviewed one of the police officers that arrested Zaytoun, Ralph Gonzalez from New Mexico, and he was a longtime police officer who came out on his own accord with his unit to help, you know, and he was told, no, you're going to be going down there to, you know, to instill law and order, command and control, all the, and they were all amped up, you know, thinking that it was going to be incredibly violent everywhere. And immediately all they did and all they found was people needing help, and they turned into, it was not law and order, but search and rescue. And so all of these units had to switch their mindset, but there was this residual effect that, you know, one of the very first things that the state did after Katrina in the area was build this outdoor prison that was nicknamed Camp Greyhound, while people were still being rescued off of roofs and dying in their attics and looking for water or food outside of the Superdome or Convention Center. They were one of the most efficient acts that any government agency performed was to build this pristine outdoor kennel, basically, for people behind the Amtrak and Greyhound station, you know, with new fencing and barbed wire atop it and well-built and very efficiently run in its way. So it showed a sort of a misallocation of resources, I feel like.
There's also the story of Zaytoun and one of his friends who also happened to have been Muslim and Arab being immediately seen as Taliban, Al-Qaeda, you know, all of that kind of prejudice and bigotry.
Well, they were, he had a friend named Nasser Daoud who he'd known for many years and who received asylum in the U.S., you know, 15 or so years before. And they were both canoeing around together some days. And anyway, he was there at one of Zaytoun's properties, a house he owned on Claiborne. They were there together when the National Guard, local police, Ralph Gonzalez and Mexico cop and some other unnamed, perhaps, mercenaries all broke in together, sort of a coalition. They broke into the house and arrested them and brought them and treated them roughly and then brought them to Camp Greyhound, where they slept outside on the cement for 3 days. And then while there, they, you know, the group of arresting officers, that was the last time they saw them. They thought that they were looters or they were trying to, they thought that they, you know, that this house on Claiborne was the home of a bunch of criminals in some way. And it's unclear. There was no real evidence ever gathered or no sort of, you know, concrete claims of any criminality. But anyway, they throw them in this Camp Greyhound, which is run by the National Guard and those that run Angola, the maximum security prison in Louisiana. And at that point, things got took a dark turn where suddenly they were called Taliban, Al-Qaeda. They were strip searched. They were suspected of perhaps some sort of larger terrorist scheme because they found some cash. Nasser had his life savings with him, as most people or many people did after the storm. And they found some computer, you know, like
chips.
Chip. It was from a camera, you know. And then another man arrested had maps on him because he delivers luggage for the airports, you know. And so
it all seemed incriminating, but
it's yeah. I mean, you know, some circumstantial evidence for sure, but it was sort of blown up into a much larger sort of question. And of course, at that point, FEMA was under Homeland Security, so they were visited by Homeland Security officials. And
the Brownie was doing a great job.
It was, you know, I mean, until I knew about Zaytoun's story, no one could have imagined such an intersection between the war on terror and the worst natural disaster in American history. But with FEMA under Homeland Security and you know, there was a mindset that was terrorism, anti-terrorism was the main purpose of these agencies at this time. And it had gone from, FEMA had gone from a very effective, you know, agency under Clinton and John Lee Witt, who used to run it, to, you know, a much less effective and with their priorities skewed agency under Bush. And after 2003, when they folded into Homeland Security, everybody agreed that it had sort of jumped off the rails.
And boy, it was like Abu Ghraib to read these descriptions. I mean, Muslim men being subjected to strip searches, like Dave said, and also being fed pork. And well, let me open the phone lines. I want to invite listeners to join us. You can do that now. It's toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a SiriusXM satellite. We welcome your calls and your emails. To call us, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786. Or if you prefer, send an email. Questions or comments are welcome. And the email address is forum@kqed.org. The book is Zaytoun, and our guest is Dave Eggers. And we will continue shortly after a brief break. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Dave Eggers, and he's written a book called Zaytoun, which is out, and which was reviewed in the Chronicle over the weekend in Insight in the book review section. And there was, I guess, a mistake there that may make people wonder about your method of journalism. Mistake that's been corrected now, I guess, on the web. So let's get that out there, like rectify it.
Well, the review was by Dan Baum, who wrote a great book called Nine Lives, and I used some of his research. He was at Katrina after the storm, and I used some of his articles that he wrote in the New Yorker as research, and I have great respect for him. He made a claim in the review. He somehow misunderstood my methods and said that I only had three sources for the book, which of course couldn't be farther from the truth. Like, the book took 3 years, and I don't think that there's anybody I didn't interview. So, including the two main arresting officers and officials at every prison, and officials at Amtrak, and then and the Homeland Security and the National Guard, and everywhere in between. So, anyway, I
read that, and I was very puzzled by it.
I was too, because I even looked back in the book. Where would he have gotten this number three people? And I still can't find it, because there are all these other sources listed. So it seemed to be pulled out of thin air. And I personally would love book reviews to be fact checked too. But anyway, one day.
There's, I would be remiss if I just didn't mention the fact that there's a movie out now that you and your wife co-wrote, Away We Go, that Sam Mendes did. When you have a movie like that, I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know anything about it really, except that it's supposed to be a pleasurable film and very different kind of story that you're telling. When you have a confluence of these things, you have a very profoundly serious story about what happened in New Orleans, and then you have a film which is a bit on the lighter side. How does that work for you?
Well, they were written at such different times. We wrote that script, my wife and I, 2005, we finished that script. And we really did it on a lark, really, something. We both have funny passages in some of our books, and, we experimented a little bit with screenplays, and so we just gave it a shot. And we were shocked that it, was made into a movie by Sam Mendes. And and then Zaytoon started in 2006, so it was 3 years of, the only thing that we ever had to do on the script was a little bit of tweaking before it was being made. So the fact that they landed so close is really strange, but it was kind of unavoidable, and I wish it, I don't know. But what are you going to do? I mean, these things happen.
Also, talk a bit about the fact that so many of these people, not only the people you write about here, the family you write about, the couple, but so many people who underwent the experience of Katrina continue to have post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, Kathy Zaytoon has had some very troubling symptoms all the way to this day. I mean, so many of the New Orleanians who either fled or stayed, they didn't necessarily have immediate symptoms, but as the months and years go by, there are things like memory loss and confusion and sleeplessness and stress and irritability, all of these things, hallmarks of post-traumatic stress syndrome. And Kathy's had, instances where she's at a bank depositing money from the business and she can't, she's forgotten where she is and what what her checkbook is and what her pen does and what are those even her hands? I mean, she's had these moments that are, heartbreaking. And she's not alone. There's thousands of people from New Orleans that are suffering various symptoms, and it's not necessarily a few months and everybody recovers. These things have long, long lasting effects.
Did you see that film? Danny Glover was the producer of it. In fact, we talked about it on the air, that young couple who took pictures of Katrina.
Trouble the Water.
Trouble the Water, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen excerpts of it. I haven't seen the whole thing.
They're powerful.
Yeah.
They're powerful. I mean, you bring Katrina back in a vivid way. In fact, one of the things, in reading your book, I kept thinking, boy, he really learned the streets. He learned his way around New Orleans. You had
yeah,
to, didn't you?
Well, you have to. So that's why, it's 3 years of sort of traveling there all the time and trying to memorize as much of it as possible, even though I know that I'm an outsider.
If you'd like to join us, feel free to do that now with Dave Eggers, talking about Katrina, talking about the experience of Katrina. It's very ordinary and decent citizens, people who showed immense courage and goodness under those terrible circumstances. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or send an email to forum@kqed.org. And Barla, join us. You're on. Good morning. Hi, Barla. Or is it Barla?
What? Hello? Oh, hi.
Yeah, hi.
I'm sorry. No, it's Carla.
Oh, Carla. Okay, sorry.
Yes. I have Well, I have two questions. One, is there anything that the author finds in his own personal story that helps you connect to these types of stories? And then I also love New Orleans, and we went to Jazz Fest. I've been many, many years for Jazz Fest. We purposely went the year after Katrina, and everything was still closed and boarded up, and the area by the fairgrounds was very hard hit by Katrina, and we tried our damnedest to spread as much money around as possible, just, tipping people like crazy, and everyone was so proud and grateful, and it was a pretty great experience. Just the resilience of locals was wonderful.
Yeah, Dave Eggers.
Well, that's I was just there over the weekend, and the thing that most New Orleanians just seem to say all the time to any visitors, just thanks for coming down here. Like they are really a lot of the local economy, of course, is tourism, and so I think that they appreciate it, especially those who come down and tell their friends, and it's not some and especially if you get out of the French Quarter a little bit and patronize some of the restaurants and other attractions that are outside of that one neighborhood, which hasn't changed so much, but you go a little bit outside in the and these communities that were much harder hit, but the city's coming back, but there are still a lot of blocks and a lot of whole neighborhoods that look like the storm happened just a few months ago.
Funny thing was that your protagonist really understood the danger of the levees. I mean, he was a guy who had that kind of insight pretty early. He was prescient, really.
Yeah, he, the second he knew that the levees had broken, he knew basically he knew how much water would be in his neighborhood, and he knew how long it would take to rebuild. This is a builder, so he knows what's going to happen to the innards of the house and how long it's going to take to come back. And, okay, going to have to get this amount of drywall, and we're going to have to get this insulation, and there's going to be mold here, and, all of these things. So I think that the day that the water came up and he was bringing all of his possessions from the first floor to the second, he called Kathy, his wife, and said, take the kids to Arizona where they have family and put them in school tomorrow because it's going to be months. And so he had a really, innate sense of all of these things as a builder.
When chaos reigns, as it did in New Orleans, well, in fact, I was thinking of that review in the Chronicle. He compared the world to Kafkaesque. I mean, maybe it's just I saw the Kafka Museum in Prague recently, but there is that sense of bureaucratic nightmares, of immobility, of paralysis, things coming to a standstill and chaos reigning.
Well, the courts in Louisiana have some dysfunction to them on a good day. And the lawyers I know down there lament it, but it's how things work. But then there were no courts functioning whatsoever. The state Supreme Court, I don't think, started up again until November. And so there was no way to even, get a petition of habeas corpus through. And, they were incarcerating people left and right, thousands of 1,200 people that went through Camp Greyhound. And there were about 8,000 prisoners that were, doing what they called Katrina time all over the state in maximum security prisons. But there were no courts functioning. There were no public defenders really to speak of. There were, I think, between 4 and 10 working in New Orleans. New Orleans funds their public defender program through parking tickets. There was nobody parking, of course. There's no cars working, so there's no funding for the public defenders. And so they were still arresting people, and there was no way to track them. And they weren't so they had all these prisoners all over the state, and no way to find them, no way to track them, and there were no lawyers, public defenders searching them out in any expedient way. And so their experiences, and Zaytoun only did 3 weeks or so in a maximum security prison, even though I say only, by comparison, some of those he was with did many months, and there are those that did over a year and were never charged for a crime.
Zaytoun also finds at one point in your narrative that there's someone put in this cage with him by the name of Jerry. this was very odd and peculiar, and it still remains a riddle to me as a reader. I don't know.
Well, it's not, you know, there's a technique that's been used by law enforcement where they put a plant in a cell to sort of try to get information out of a prisoner and sort of gain their trust and get a confession or get some information. And Zaytoun and Nasser were in this prison in the Camp Greyhound in this outdoor cage. And one day there was just another man put in there, his name Jerry, and he seemed to be in very good spirits considering that he was put in a jail after a hurricane. And he tried to chat them up, and for about a day and a half tried to chat up Zaytoun and Nasser about problems with the U.S. and wasn't this a terrible country and don't they have a terrible policy toward the Middle East and things like that, in between cracking jokes and trying to and being a generally entertaining guy. So it made no sense because never was anyone else put in their cage, and otherwise all the other cages were, you know, separated and they were isolated. You know, they came to think that this guy was a plant that was trying to get some sort of anti-American information out of the two Syrian Americans. So
the irony is these guys loved America. Actually.
Of course. Yeah. You know, you will never find a bigger fan of this country than Zaytoun because he lived every bit of the American dream. You know, he had a prosperous business, great family, totally woven into every aspect of life in the city. I mean, anyone in the city, when the book came out, everyone that, you know, people are constantly stopping Zaytoun on the street. Like, oh, I know you, you know, you're that guy. And because his logo is all over the city, his signs are all over the city, this Zaytoun logo with a paintbrush and a rainbow behind it, you can't miss him. He's painted or worked in half the houses in the city.
And when you say cage, you're being literal, right?
It's a cage, yeah. These pictures, you can find them online. YouTube has film of the cages operating. They're just, they look exactly like kennels, but they're a little taller and made for men and women with a porta potty in each one of them. But otherwise, there's nowhere to sit. And they weren't allowed to sit near the edge of the fence. They weren't allowed to touch the fence. So if any prisoners touched the fence, they were taken out and tied up and put face down on the cement and then pepper sprayed to sort of serve as an example for the other prisoners.
You've got a lot of photos in the book, family photos, and some letters too as well that I guess were given to you by them?
Yeah, you know, when Zaytoun was sleeping, he stayed in his house, and the days after the storm, at night, after he would canoe around the city, he would either sleep in his daughter Nadima's room or sleep on the roof. And he had saved all the family photos and the albums and everything. So he had a lot of time to sort of, you know, re-explore these memories from way back. And his brother, Ahmed in Spain, is like a meticulous record keeper and photo hoarder. And so he had, you know, this a collection of photos that he hadn't looked at in a while. And so I thought it would be, you know, important to sort of show some of these photos of Zaytoun as a sailor and Zaytoun's house in Syria and sort of his life even before he got to the U.S.
We're talking to Dave Eggers about Zaytoun, which is his newest book. And here's Ariana, who writes, have you discussed the obvious racism? It was mostly white military police dealing with mostly black or people of color in New Orleans. And as elsewhere, racism distorts the rescuer's view and turns them into fill-in-the-blank rapists, terrorists, robbers, murderers, etc. We see this everywhere in the U.S. and Iraq, etc., wherever the U.S. takes their military.
Well, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think it's been spoken about and covered a lot that so much of the response to the storm assumptions were made about, well, yeah, mass looting and chaos is logical given, you know, that New Orleans is a high-crime city and that, you know, you would see these pictures on CNN these comparisons have been made many times. When black New Orleanians were shown getting supplies from a Walgreens, it was looting. And then white New Orleanians, it was, you know, resourcefulness. And so I think, the legacy of what perceptions came out of that storm, it'll take years or decades to sort out. I think it was really one of the most revealing and troubling episodes in American history. But in the case of the Zaytouns, I interviewed two of the officers. There were a diverse group of officers that arrested them, but two of the officers that I interviewed, one a New Orleans policeman and one the cop from New Mexico, neither their arrest wasn't based on their heritage. They didn't really know. They had been casing this house, and they thought that they were looters, and they didn't know, you know.
Well, the guy Gonzalez, in fact, was Mexican, I assume.
Well, he's Latino, and one of the officers was African-American National Guards woman, and so, but they didn't know their heritage. It wasn't until they got to Camp Greyhound that that's when the charges of Al-Qaeda and Taliban and stuff started ringing out. But certainly the atmosphere that they entered, all these officers and soldiers coming into the city, was greatly fueled by, I think, some deep-seated prejudices.
Well, one thing, in fact, that that I was struck by was some of those who were acting as guards were accusing homosexuality, bisexuality, whereas Zaytoun was concerned, which was, as a Muslim, was even more humiliating in many ways to him personally.
Well, you know, he and Nasser were isolated at Hunt Correctional Center, this maximum security prison up in St. Gabriel, Louisiana, and every time a guard would go by, Zaytoun would jump up from, they had to share, trade off sharing this one bed in the cell, and he would jump up to the bars to try to get his attention and try to get a phone call, because he was never given a phone call. And this guard started implying that they were engaged in some kind of sexual activity and that Zaytoun was jumping up to sort of disguise this. And that really got Zaytoun angry as a married man. That he would suddenly become unfaithful to his wife after a week of imprisonment. And there were, you know, constant humiliations. And at Hunt, they were strip searched every week. And so they were treated. Hunt is actually a fairly well-run prison as these go. I was able to sort of sneak into the prison under different auspices. But so I was able to sort of see how it was run and meet a lot of the administrators. But these prisoners were denied basic rights because they were technically under FEMA's umbrella. They weren't processed in a normal Hunt Correctional Center way. FEMA was paying for their incarceration. And so they sort of got lost in the mix, as did a lot of prisoners all over the state.
A lot of emails. Let me go through some of them. Jesse writes, I wonder if you think there is something that has been lost as a result of the tragedy in New Orleans, having never been there. Will there be an attitude, charm never to be recovered or experienced by people like me?
I don't think so. I think the city hasn't, every time I've been there since the storm, it still feels like New Orleans. There's definitely an underlying melancholy that's new. This was a city that always expected the big one. There was always jokes about this for decades or even longer. And
sort of like San Francisco and the earthquake.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's a gallows humor like, well, when that one comes, you know, and this place is a punch bowl, because it is all mostly of it, most of the city is underwater, I mean, under sea level. So I think that there was an expectation that it could happen at some point. I think that but there's an anger in how it was handled. You know, I think had it been a different political atmosphere and had the FEMA done its job, I think that that kind of bitterness and wouldn't necessarily be there, even though the sadness might be there.
Another listener, Dan, writes, I'm curious about your reference to the flooding as a natural disaster. Since the storm passed without much effect, isn't the levee failure and the Army Corps' culpability the real culprit? And he goes on to say, P.S., I think you're a great American. Thanks for 826 Valencia and the others. I've seen the one in Ann Arbor, too.
That's a really good point. You know, that's a little bit above my pay grade in terms of how much of it was natural disaster and how much was the, you know, because the levees were overtopped before they broke, and how much of it was the failure of the engineering. And I'm not an engineer, and I know that there is definitely culpability there with the Army Corps of Engineers. And it's an area that I don't go into as much because I don't have the expertise. But certainly there's a shared blame for sure. And, you know, it was a natural disaster. And the storm passed, and there was just a little bit of water in the city, and it would have drained had the levees not failed.
Jeff writes, I love Dave Eggers' writing. He's got a great style, and I specifically enjoyed his writing in State by State, What is the What, and Heartbreaking Work. I ordered Zaytoun already and can't wait to read it. I find Dave's writing is more compelling when it is based on real-life stories. I felt so much more for Valentino Deng than characters in You Shall Know Our Velocity, where I found it hard to identify with characters that have trouble spending money. Does Dave harbor a preference for nonfiction-like storytelling? He seems to be becoming almost a great journalist writer. I suppose he means as opposed to maybe the other kind.
Yeah, I started out as a journalist, and that was my training. And
going back to your roots.
Yeah, you know, I think most of what I've written, even in fictional form, is based pretty closely on research. And the trip in You Shall Know Our Velocity, where two guys try to get around the world in a week and give away about $32,000, like, I had to go to all those places, you know, Senegal, Morocco, and Estonia, and Latvia, and do so in a week. I traveled that route before writing the book, because I think it just always goes back to sort of research for me. I feel like I've only written a few things that are, you know, completely based on, you know, just made up. And I have a young adult or all ages book coming out in the fall that's that. And it's a lot more fun to write, to sit there and not have to be beholden to any facts or people or cities. And but I don't know. I guess, yeah, you do go back to your roots.
Here's Brian, who says, your first novel, Heartbreaking Work, was very funny. Have you abandoned irony?
Well, it always depends on how you define irony.
There are actually some funny moments in this book.
Well, Kathy and Zaytoun are very funny together. Their banter is, you know, sitcom worthy in a way, because he's got, you know, it's he's funny, but she's really a storyteller and very talkative, and you know, she gets him, and they will, you know, because they work constantly. So they're on the phone dozens of times a day, and they've got five kids, and they've got this business, and there's the duck, and then there's the two cats, and, you know, they're always renovating their own house. And so, you know, they'll banter. And so over the years, I just really got to know their rhythm and sort of, and she always gets the best of them, always has the last word, and always with some really hilarious put down. And so I try to get that in there, but yeah, no, I still like writing funny. This other book, this All Ages book, is based on Where the Wild Things Are. Is
the Maurice Sendak.
Yeah. So that's I think pretty funny.
People want to know what's happened to Valentino.
Valentino is doing exceedingly well. He's back in his hometown of Mario Bay at the moment, but he lives most of the time in Nairobi with his wife and son, who's, how old is he now? Maybe 7 months old. Aru, who's a really cute kid.
So remember, we did an event, he was just getting married.
Yeah, no, and, you know, with, he created the Valentino Ashak Deng Foundation to build, you know, create educational opportunities in southern Sudan and in the U.S. And in a miraculous amount of time, he was able to build what's right now a 14-structure secondary school complex in his hometown. And the biggest and most successful and ambitious school project that I can think of in his entire region of southern Sudan, if not the whole south of the country. And he did it in a way that nobody else could have done, I think. He is like the master runner of NGOs, and I think that other NGOs trying to
now
build
I get it.
Schools.
You're drawing the builders. That's what it is.
Yeah, you know what? But Valentino didn't have experience with this, but he is a master builder and contractor, this guy. Like, I've seen him negotiate prices for bricks and for, you know, roofing, and he is ruthless. And but, you know, because he has local knowledge and the support of the community, he was able to build this complex in record time. And, you know, there'll be about 400 students going there by the end of the summer. The official opening is August 16th, so I have to be out there for that.
Emily writes, Dave, I understand this is irrelevant to the current topic, but I'm dying to know, how is Toph?
Oh, my brother Toph. He's doing great. He's 26. He's lives in L.A. He's a screenwriter, and he's doing incredibly well. He's and very tall. He and Valentino are both. I'm just thinking Valentino the same height. They're both about 6'3" or so. So I don't know.
Your brother's name is sort of like. It was one of those ones I never heard pronounced. I wasn't sure. Was it Zaytoun? Zaytoun? Was it Toph? Toph?
I know. I failed twice to put the phonetic pronunciation in there, and I'm kicking myself. But yeah, Toph, short for Christopher.
Here's a playwright named Krish who writes, "Whatever happened to your wonderful play Sacrament, adapted from an earlier novel of yours? I saw it performed by Camposanto at Intersection for the Arts a few years ago and thought it was terrific, worthy of a future life in the off-Broadway world for sure. Please tell me that you're doing something with it. It deserves to be heard."
Wow. Thank you. You know, I give all credit to Camposanto and Sean San Jose and Kent Nicholson and everybody who put on that play there. They did it. You know, I didn't, I was involved in so much as just a few tweaks here and there, but they're the masters of theater. They just sort of take books, and they're right now, they just finished a run of Juno Diaz's Oscar Wilde, and which was amazing. And so I don't know what happens. I don't know that world. They had a really nice run, and I think they extended it a few times, and then... and then that's the last I knew of it. But I don't know how these things work in theater, but I really appreciate that writer's saying so, because I thought that that company did an incredible job.
Actually, I read this book as almost being like a five-act play. I think, I mean, we talk about the journalism in the novel, but it was really like a five-act play structure.
Yeah, yeah, unconsciously for sure, but... but yeah, I think it does have that, the Zaytoven is broken up. I guess it is into five parts, isn't it?
Yeah. Zaytoven is Dave Eggers' new book, and all the proceeds go again?
Well, you know, Valentino wanted to actually build schools, but in New Orleans, there's already so many great nonprofits operating there. So we just decided to make a very sort of lean nonprofit. It's a fiscally sponsored project of another nonprofit in New Orleans, and just... as a granting agency to all these other nonprofits that are working there. So a few days ago, I was able to visit a bunch of them, everything from the Innocence Project, which is a natural choice, you know, that helps wrongfully incarcerated men and women, to Rebuilding Together, the Green Project, all these people trying to sort of rebuild the city and do so in a sensible and even environmentally friendly way.
Thank you for your work. It is an extraordinary work. Stay tuned. Dave Eggers, our guest. We're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell, and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.